полиция задержала еще двух активисток группы «Пусси».
На самом деле правильно сделали, что его арестовали.
Суд приговорил признать Толоконникову Надежду Андреевну виновной в совершении
преступления. Хулиганство по мотивам религиозной ненависти.
Я не признаю себя виновной.
В конце концов докатили до суда, а суд влепил им двушечку.
One year ago, much of the world's eyes were on a Moscow courtroom where three young women were on trial for a two-minute act of defiance in the Russian capital's main Orthodox Christian cathedral. Their act and the authorities' disproportionate response won them sympathy across much of the world. Pop culture icons like Madonna and Paul McCartney took up their cause. But while Pussy Riot graffiti and t-shirts may have appeared all over Europe and the United States, the feminist punk rock collective's performance in Moscow's Christ the Savior Cathedral exposed deep divisions in Russian society, divisions the Kremlin was eager to exploit for its own ends. In the wake of the Pussy Riot trial, the authorities initiated a cultural war that rages to this day. Soon after the two-year prison sentences were handed down, there came a so-called blasphemy law, making it a crime to insult someone's religious sensibilities, and another prohibiting so-called gay propaganda. Following this came a wave of violent homophobic attacks. Having lost the urban middle class, President Vladimir Putin was clearly appealing to the conservative heartland, playing to their latent fears and deepest prejudices. One year after the Pussy Riot verdict, Russia's cultural war is in full swing. But is anybody winning? Hello and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me via Skype from London is co-host Kirill Kobudin of RFRL's Russian service and a contributor to the online magazine Politru. Welcome, Kirill.
Hello.
And on the all-important Skype line is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of the excellent Sean's Russia blog. Welcome back, Sean.
Hello.
So we all know what we're going to be talking about today, so let's just get right to it. Sean, the current manifestation of what we've dubbed a cultural war between traditional and modern Russia, if you will, has been going on for about a year since this verdict on August the 17th of last year. To get things going, is anybody winning? Is the Kremlin getting what it wanted here? And where do you see this going?
Well, before I answer those two questions, I think it's important to establish, well, what is the kind of context for this, and also what are the goals? And here I'd like to give a bit of a historical perspective. We've seen culture wars in Russian history really since the 19th century. The first one we could speak about is Nicholas I after the Decembrist uprising with his official nationality, Orthodox nationality. Then we have another one by Alexander III, after the assassination of Alexander II by revolutionaries. Then we have another cultural war in the late 1920s and early 1930s, the beginning of the Stalinist years, and then another one in late 1960s and 1970s. Now, what's interesting about all of these is that they follow periods of liberalization, both political and cultural. And what's interesting also about these cultural wars, if we want to extend the term back in time, is what are they trying to do? And here I would argue that they are trying to redefine the cultural community of Russia. And it's important to speak about this redefinition. It's not establishing who is a member, but establishing who isn't a member of that community. And I think in a lot of ways, the cultural war we're seeing under Putin is a way to redefine the Russian cultural community by identifying who doesn't belong in it, and through that defining who is a member of it. Now, to your question of who is winning, I think it's hard to say, actually. I guess one could say that Putin is winning by default. All of the laws have been passed, they're enforced, they haven't really been used to any great extent, but they're there nonetheless. And most of the population seems to just passively at least accept these laws and not really, segments of the population, of course, trying to resist them. But for the most part, there hasn't been much of a kind of outcry from the population in general. And I think it's important to, when we think about Putin's cultural war now, is to remember that he is a very conservative man. I think we've underestimated Putin's social and conservatism until this point, mostly because he hasn't really shown it in a public way. But it's always been there. So in terms of where it's going, I think it's hard to say. I mean, it depends on how what other legislation they're going to bring up in the coming year or beyond that.
No, you've given us a lot to chew on here. I mean, I think it's interesting that not only have each of those periods you named, Nicholas I, Alexander II, Stalin, and the rise of Brezhnev, each of them followed a period of liberalization, but two of them also followed kind of a trauma, the Decemberist uprising and the assassination of Alexander II.
And the Revolution of 1917.
And the Revolution of 1917. They each have been in reaction to something. Putin's, of course, was in reaction to a revolution that wasn't sort of. It really is. It's a slow. If it's a revolution, it's a slow burning revolution. You're absolutely correct about how we've underestimated Putin's conservatism. Again, as a correspondent in the 90s, I had the opportunity to watch the man up close in Petersburg when he was vice mayor, and he was considered a liberal. He was considered a liberal. I remember writing a piece back when Putin first became head of the FSB, and I had people like Yuri Schmidt saying, "We finally got somebody in the FSB. That's not going to be a knuckle dragger." I mean, those are my words, not his. Yuri Markovich, rest his soul, was a much more eloquent man than that. But so you've given us a lot to chew on, Kirill. What's your take here? I think Sean's made some good points here.
Yes, very interesting all the things about, these cultural wars, but I'll redefine them as a cultural campaigns, official cultural campaigns. That was not the war because there weren't two sides of this war. That was just one active player. The state, in the case of Nicholas I or Alexander III, that was the Tsar during Stalin's times, that was, Stalin himself and so on. I am not, such agree with you about Brezhnev times. That was not a cultural war or cultural campaign. That was a, desperate attempt to freeze the recent situation, which was rather liberal in comparison to, Stalin's times and so on. But that is all,
But it was a rollback of Khrushchev's thaw, for sure.
In political sense, yes. In cultural, not. I'm absolutely sure. Yeah. Absolutely sure. Look at the history of, Soviet cinema in 1970s, Soviet literature and so on. Solzhenitsyn himself didn't, play the only role, the only huge role in this process. But it's not, it's quite interesting, in academic sense. But in political sense, it just came to me that maybe we can compare also this situation with China in the end of 1960s. Do you remember so-called Cultural Revolution?
Of course.
Cultural Revolution, yes, by Mao Zedong. What was the aim of this process? Of course, theoretically, that was, a fulfillment Lenin's idea, yes, of threefold socialist revolution, industrialization, collectivization, and cultural revolution, yes, the third, step. But pragmatically, that was also a desperate attempt to strengthen Mao's rule.
Mao felt he was losing his power at that point. He was losing a degree of his power. Yes. That's
and
correct.
He invented the very idea of, a sort of controlled popular uprising against, the tradition, Chinese tradition. Yeah. And what can we say about, and when we speak about, recent situation with so-called cultural war in Russia, I think, first of all, about this Chinese example, because that was an attempt to strengthen his own rule, Putin's attempt to strengthen his own rule, only with the means of so-called cultural counter-revolution. To redefine not as a Russia as a community, but to redefine Russia or being Russian as a tradition. Mm-hmm. It's all about defining the tradition. It's not about the ideology. That was, the meaning of Chinese Cultural Revolution. That was the meaning of cultural war by, Nicholas I with his, triada, so-called, yes, and official narodnosti and so on. But that was all about ideology. Now, this cultural war is not about ideology. It's about, a very, strange and in some sense academic thing as a redefining of Russian tradition.
Or I would agree with Sean. It's redefining what is not right. You know, what is not Russian.
Yes.
It's about exclusion as much as anything. These touchy feely feminist gay loving sissies in the Capitol aren't real Russians. Pussy Riot. These spoiled brats aren't real Russians. Go ahead.
The problem is that you cannot define the tradition only excluding some or several things. You must include some the most important values of this tradition.
So what is this now? Mujiki in the provinces and in the Orthodox Church? What is it?
They cannot use all of them because, first of all, they are very bad propagandists. And I think Stalin just, you know, would send
would have been rid of them very quickly.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. They are absolutely talentless. They failed in every, you know, step they made. But anyway, they try to find, you know, these values, but these values just disappeared when they touch them. And that is the problem.
Well, as I wrote in the blog yesterday, they're playing with symbols that at first glance appear to have a very potent cultural content. But if you scratch the surface, they're really empty vessels. I wanted to go back to your point because I thought it was a good point when you pointed out these four other cultural campaigns/wars that took place in Russian history, Nicholas I, Alexander III, Stalin, and Brezhnev. There was only one side, so therefore they were campaigns and not wars. What I'm wondering, and this is an open question, do we have two sides this time? Because I see the other side fighting back. Yeah, the state's got all the guns, but they don't have all the media anymore. And I see the other side very effectively pushing back this time and winning this war with humor, or not winning it, but fighting it with humor as much as anything else and cleverness. Both of you, I want to hear from whoever wants to jump in first. Go ahead. Sean, go ahead.
Yeah, I think that, well, in this case, I think there tends to be, in some of the historical examples, there aren't two sides. Definitely, I think Kirill's campaign model works well. But in the case of Alexander III, there was another side. There was the literature and art movement, artists in Imperial Russia, and there was the revolutionary movement also pushing back. So,
which ultimately won.
But thanks to his inept son.
Right.
There certainly is another, and that's, I think, really the condition of Russia today. I mean, we have to remember, despite these historical analyses, that it isn't the Soviet period, it isn't the Tsarist period. You do have, I think the civil society of Russia has been underestimated. I think it's there, and it can be vibrant, especially when it's essentially attacked. It's starting to rear its head, still in a small sense, but it's there nonetheless. But I would go back to the question of, is this really about re-strengthening Putin's rule or about Putin's rule in general? I wrote about this recently. And if we think of Putinism as a reconstitution of various pillars of Russian society, the economy, the state, politics, the cultural sphere is logically the last pillar that he needs to reestablish to create a post-Soviet Russia. Now, granted, I totally agree that the symbols that they're playing with don't communicate that well. They're not good propagandists at all. It doesn't go that deep. But at the same time, it's also part of the historical condition. We're living in postmodern ages, in a postmodern age, where grand narratives fall apart because of the proliferation of different identities. So it's incredibly difficult. And I would stress it is about reestablishing a political community or a cultural community. I see establishing Russian tradition basically the same thing. But it's hard to coalesce a society as diverse with so many different ethnic, cultural identities under one grand narrative for Russia, or any society for that matter.
How would you assess the other Russia's pushback on this?
Well, that's actually interesting too, because you're getting a similar dynamic. You're getting the creation of a political community on the other side. That's also mostly to a large extent through negation. They are not the kind of Russian traditional values. They move more towards the West. They're a little bit more proactive in their definition, but that proactive stance really is in the context of being negated from the Russian society, right? I would argue that what's interesting about the anti-gay propaganda legislation is that it essentially conjured homosexuals in Russia into existence.
Mm-hmm. As a social force.
Before, there was certainly a gay rights movement, but it was very small and it was far less visible and far less vocal. And now this is all anyone is talking about.
And as we put out an excellent piece this week by our Moscow correspondent Tom Baumforth about how straight activists have actually been spurred into action by this. People
right.
who never thought about this issue before. And they're not just in Moscow and Petersburg. The star of the story, this blogger, is not in Moscow or Petersburg, but in Nizhny Tagil. Could you imagine being an LGBT activist there in the heartland in the Urals? But this is happening, and this wasn't happening before, but now it's happening. So that's interesting. I wanna play a clip from back in February of Patriarch Kirill talking. We were searching around for something that really epitomized something Putin said or something the Patriarch said that epitomized the regime's call to arms on this issue. And I want to play this clip from Kirill and get you both to react. Let's listen to Kirill.
Началась волна богохульств, кощунств, актов вандализма.
There has been a wave of blasphemy, sacrilege, acts of vandalism and desecration of sacred Orthodox places. And this wave has spread not only across Russia, but also to other countries of historical Rus'. This campaign has been clearly aimed at discrediting the Church as the bearer of the foundations of our values and the thousand-year moral ideal of our society.
Kirill, I want to provoke you to respond to the words of another Kirill, whose views are very different from yours. Is the Church the bearer of the foundation of the values of Russia's 1,000-year history? I mean, how important is Orthodoxy in Russianness?
Definitely not. From the very beginning of 18th century. That was so absolutely during the, you know, Kiev and Moscow period of Russian history. But after Peter the First, who broke, you know, in some sense, he broke the very spirit of independent Orthodox Church in Russia, making Orthodox Church and Patriarchy just another one ministry in his government, synod, so-called, mm-hmm. yes, that was a ministry of Orthodox religion in some sense. And the head of this ministry was a layman, was a bureaucrat, mm-hmm. not a priest. And after that, Orthodox Church didn't have even the authority to speak on behalf of Russian population, of Russians, because that was just a part of multicultural, multi-ethnic empire. And that is very important. So the authority, the state, was much higher than Orthodox Church during all imperial period of Russian history. And the same, even the worst, was after the October Revolution. And moreover, in some sense, I don't want to insult, you know, some Orthodox believers and so on. But
you will.
Okay, but the hierarchy of Orthodox Church didn't resist the Soviet rule. All the period of, from 1923-24, didn't resist even this. And that was, Orthodox Church became just another feature of Russian life. Just another one feature. Not the, you know, the content of Russian. Not the, you know, the essential thing in Russian life. Just another one feature. Interesting, in some sense important, but not the only one. Soviet society was a modernized society, and that was the result not just of October Revolution and Lenin's cause, but even the Stalinist period and Brezhnev period, Khrushchev and Brezhnev period. And now we have a very different society from the very idea of being Orthodox or something like this. Of course, Orthodox religion is very useful in some sense as an exemplary value for the building or constructing of so-called Russianness. Of course, it's very useful for Putin himself and for Kremlin. But This is a very serious mistake to try to, you know, to depend on this thing, to depend on the popularity of Orthodox Church in Russian society. Because, as we told a lot of times during our podcasts, there are just few true believers in Russia.
Yes.
And that is the problem. Orthodox Church became one of the, you know, points of understanding your own identity as a Russian. But that is just only another one point, and that is all. That's my opinion.
So it's a flimsy sand to build a foundation of a culture war. Sean, what do you think?
Well, I think it's interesting to look and see what Kirill was saying. The Kirill, the patriarch, not Kirill the, on our show. His language was entirely one of being attacked.
Mm-hmm.
It's based in, I think, a lot of Orthodox identity amongst the believers. And I agree with Kirill. I mean, Orthodoxy is Russian Orthodoxy is for the most part quite an empty identity. But for those who really believe it and are active in the church, it's a major identity of trauma. And if you consider the history, the one that Kirill just outlined, it is a history of feeling under attack, whether it's from society or from the state, or the state and society working together, as we saw in the early Soviet period.
And if I'm not mistaken, suffering plays a very central role in Orthodox doctrine.
Certainly, but and here they have actual historical memory to base that suffering in, right? It doesn't have to be in liturgy and these things. And I think this is really interesting because – on the one hand, the Putin system has very few traditional concepts to base a post-Soviet Russian identity on. It can't use Russianness because of the multi-ethnicity of the country. It can't use Orthodoxy because, as Kirill just said, there's real no strength to the Orthodox Church. Russians may identify themselves as Orthodox, but what that actually means is quite thin.
Mm-hmm.
They can't use, say, Tsarism or a Tsar, though they've tried, because in the Democrat, as you know, the democracy of that Russia actually has, people are getting tired of looking at Putin the Tsar and his antics. So they can't. That worked for a little while. It doesn't work anymore. They can't use, say, the economy because you're getting a polarization of haves and have-nots. So they try to play with these traditional symbols as best they can, but they're really kind of empty in content, and they can't find a basis for redefining them. So what did they do? They turn to enemies.
Right.
And they turn to people they can exclude, whether it's the West, whether it's liberals, etc. And I think in the end, this is a failed concept because you can't keep the fervor of campaigns against enemies going on for too long. They lose their kind of potency. If they ever had it.
Well, and in one sense, you know, along came Pussy Riot, and they appeared for a time to be the perfect enemy, the perfect embodiment of what they wanted to exclude. But if you look at this now, a year down the road, and we're talking about this cultural campaign or this cultural war that the authorities are clearly struggling to win. I mean, there is another side this time, and you have to wonder. Nadezhda Tolokonnikova and Maria Alokhin are still in prison and certainly most likely will be till the end of their sentences. But did they win? They've sparked this discussion in society, and this other Russia has reared its head. Did they get what they were out to get in the first place? You have to wonder. What are your thoughts on that? Go ahead, Kirill.
The question who is winning this cultural war is very, first of all, of course, important, but it's very difficult because who is this judge who will say, or who would say, who is the winner in this game? In some sense, maybe in a very short perspective, maybe the Kremlin will win the battle, not the campaign. Of course, Kremlin is clumsy in all these ideological, you know, wars and campaigns. Its propagandists are very, you know, not such clever and witty like Moscow liberal intelligentsia and Facebook users and so on. But just remember that For instance, Napoleon Bonaparte was much better as a general, war leader than, you know, say, Wellington, Kutuzov, and all these other Wittgensteins, yeah? but he lost.
Well, because he made the stupid mistake of invading Russia in the winter.
Yes, and stupid mistake losing from the side Blücher's army before the Waterloo. But anyway, he lost the war, yes?
Mm-hmm.
But eventually, the very ideas of Napoleon as a, you know, idea of national state, the Napoleonic way or type of legislation and so on, eventually, you know, conquered Europe. And became a part of a very important part of European and then American life. And then, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
I think in a short perspective, Kremlin could win this company in even maybe the war. But it cannot win, you know, the series of these wars, and eventually it will, you know, fail.
So the other side wins by not losing, basically, just by surviving to fight another day.
Yes, because the aims of these two sides are absolutely different. Kremlin is trying to, you know, to survive. Yes, to survive somehow. And their opponents, they are thinking, or they pretend that they're thinking, being, you know, skeptically, that they're thinking about Russia's future.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, those who are speaking about future, they win always, but eventually, maybe not now.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing I've noticed about this is that humor seems to be on the side of the modern cosmopolitan Russia. They seem to be having a little bit more fun with this. And warning to those out there with sensitive sensibilities, stop listening now because the conversation is going to get a little risky now, just so everybody knows. We've all kind of followed the recent events around Mizulina's list. Yelena Mizulina, the author of the law passed by the State Duma that outlawed the propagation to minors of so-called non-traditional sexual relations. That's a quote. She was ridiculed online, in the blogs, and on Twitter, on television even. And people have been openly speculating, well, what does this mean? Is she going to, you know, ban oral sex? Right? Well, we all know she filed a criminal slander suit against a bunch of people, including television personality Ksenia Sobchak, former Deputy Prime Minister Alfred Koch, and others who have made this suggestion and ended up looking just silly in the process. And in by extension, made the regime look pretty damn silly. I want to play a clip from just the most amazing interview I've ever seen. It was Ksenia Sobchak being interviewed on Dosh TV, describing her interrogation in this criminal libel case. Let's listen to that clip, and then we'll go from there.
I came in for questioning. The investigator was a young man of 32, a serious-looking man sitting across the desk from me wearing a blue shirt. He asked about my first name, my last name, my place of work. And then his first question literally was, where did you learn that Yelena Mizulina takes a negative attitude toward oral sex and is going to legally ban it?
Oy vey, what are we going to tell the children? Sean, you wrote two very good blog posts very recently. One of them, Family Values as Putin's Fourth Pillar, which you referenced a little bit earlier. And another, Russia's Descent into Absurdity. And as I'm, and these are both right in front of me in the studio right now, and I'm looking at them both, and I can't help but think these two things go hand in hand, right? They're related to each other. Is Putin's family values campaign, as you call it, I called it a cultural war. Funny how we put these American monikers on all of these things, but we can't help ourselves. Are these two things related? Is this doomed to absurdity? Because the Mizulina Sobchak thing, I'm sorry, I mean, this was just a laugh-a-thon for the last couple of weeks. This has gotten, I mean, do a search for this on Google News, Russian, in Russian, and you'll get like 30,000 hits in the last couple of weeks. And the entire society is, not the entire set, but this is causing a lot of giggles. So does this naturally descend into absurdity?
I mean, one of the problems is that if you want to have a reestablish, say, as I use, family values for society. If you do it in a campaign model, campaigns tend to be based on that they need scandals to fuel them. And at some point, these scandals become completely ridiculous. And I think the Mizulina and Sobchak scandal is a perfect example of how absurd these things are getting now. I mean, and it's actually funny that on the one hand, Mizulina is trying to promote, you know, good Russian family values. That's kind of I described it as a combination of old Domostroy peasant values with some sort of conservatism. Here she, on the one hand, is trying to promote this, and on the other, her own scandal provokes the discussion of oral sex in Russian society. I mean, there's a idea in kind of social theory called the repressive hypothesis, that the more you try to repress certain ideas, the more you have to speak about them. Therefore, the more they are in society. And I think that we're getting to a point where this is why I said that they've conjured homosexuality into existence in Russia, because in order to put these groups in their place and to promote their kind of negative values, they have to speak about them. Therefore, they're in a way aiding the other side in their own promotion.
Right. No, and the political commentator Valera Novodvorskaya pointed out in a recent interview, she said that Mizulina should be ashamed of herself because of her, Russian children are being exposed. And I jokingly said, oy vey, what do we tell the children? Well, I mean, if I were a Russian parent, I wouldn't let my kids watch the news right now.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the great irony and points exactly to the absurdity of it.
Kirill, what are your thoughts on this?
First of all, of course, it's a very shameful degradation of ideological work in Russia. Can you imagine, you know, say, Suslov, main Brezhnev's propagandist, and on discussing oral sex on the, you know, pages of Pravda or something like this? It's ridiculous. But speaking seriously, what do all of them, what do they want to do? Kremlin try to somehow to reinvent American neoconservatism as a Russian thing.
I've noticed that as well.
Yes. Yeah. That is very interesting. It's not Russian tradition, because all these values which they are speaking about are, you know, we can group them in two, three parts. Yes, it's family, church, and market, yeah? Right. Or, you know, free market, or, you know, capitalism, or whatever, yeah? And that is an absolutely American thing. That is, in some sense, Kremlin plays a role.
It's an American right wing. It's a thing of the American right.
Yes. Not, of course, all American tradition. Of course, no. But that is a very American neoconservative thing. And in some sense, Kremlin is playing like, you know, a foreign agent.
Well, the funny thing, when this Mizulina thing went down, I mean, I could not help but think, you know, about the Clinton-Lewinsky business in the 90s, yeah. Right? Because a similar thing is going on.
Absolutely.
In the Russian media. And I remember when the Lewinsky thing was going on, and I was living in Russia at the time, and my friends and colleagues were, you know, giving me a lot of hell about, God, what has happened to American discourse? You guys are having these ridiculous conversations about, you know, these indecent things on the television. And here we are, you know, 20 years or so down, not quite, 15 years or so down the road, and the same damn thing's happening in Russia. But the thing about the Lewinsky incident was it raised the popularity. At the end of the day, Clinton became more popular as a result of this. And one has to wonder if this isn't going to have the opposite effect, because the roles are kind of reversed here, and decrease the popularity of the regime, which is already falling. Before we Kirill, one you wanted to jump.
Yes, it's a very important thing that trying to reinvent, you know, American neoconservatism as a Russian thing, they cannot understand that all of these things, you know, in American contexts, they are very serious and based on American history, American tradition, the tradition of the first people who settled in this continent, and so on. And all these values are absolutely empty in post-Soviet Russia, because family as a traditional, you know, thing was destroyed during Soviet times. Property or you know whatever was absolutely destroyed during Soviet times, and the church, we just discussed this thing. So they try to invent a very, you know, absolutely non-existing thing in Russian public opinion, and that's why they are so silly. They're playing not just with symbols, they're playing just with the non-existing things.
Sean, last word to you before we move on to the second half.
Yeah, just really quickly, I mean, from what, just bouncing off of what Kirill said, it really shows that maybe they recognize that how atomized Russian society is, that they're trying to, all of the things that Kirill just mentioned are instruments for kind of binding society or binding groups mm-hmm. of people. But here we have a situation where society is atomized, and we're in the places it's coming together are in the civil society realm.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's actually quite interesting.
Where there's actually some glue holding society
exactly.
together, which is why, and this is a good point to move on. This is maybe why the other Russia, as I have dubbed it, maybe winning this thing in the long run. In a few minutes, we'll continue our discussion of the fallout from the Pussy Riot trial 1 year on and actually talk a little bit about Pussy Riot. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me via Skype from London is co-host Kirill Coburn of RFERL's Russian service and a contributor to the online magazine Politru. And also on the all-important Skype line is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. That was a clip from the latest Pussy Riot video, Like a Red Prison, which was an attack on Russia's oil industry. The interesting thing about this clip is that it appeared to expose a rift among members of Pussy Riot, if you can use the word member to describe members of Pussy Riot. Jailed Pussy Riot members Nadezhda Tolokonnikova and Maria Alokina supported the project, and Tolokonnikova's husband, Pyotr Vasilov, actively promoted it. According to reports, Tolokonnikova actually wrote some of the lyrics for that song. But Yekaterina Samutsevich, who was initially sentenced with the other two but later released on bail, distanced herself from it entirely. I remember this as we were putting this story out about this, because there was a little confusion actually in the beginning about whether the video might actually be a hoax. It turned out to be real, but it turned out to be that everybody wasn't entirely on board with it. This all illustrated the very loose nature of Pussy Riot itself, with its anonymous rotating membership. It's hard to be really sure who actually speaks for the group sometimes, which leads to the question, a year after their trial, what is Pussy Riot? What do they signify? What's their legacy? Sean.
That's a hard question.
Or I can go to Kirill. I can go to Kirill first.
Go to
Kirill
first.
Kirill, I'm sure will have something to say about this. He's grinning.
I think first legacy or first part of legacy is a very strange, from the Western point of view, but a very strange combination of various agendas, which had been set up by Pussy Riot. Of course, they didn't invent them, but they made them, you know, public and popular in some sense. And first of them is a feminist thing, I think. And that is why I think Katya Samutsevich distanced herself from this last video and last song, because it's all about, you know, economy, about politics, about oil and all these things, but it's not a feminist thing. And
I also thought maybe since she was out on bail, she kind of had to be careful.
It's a pragmatic explanation, but I'd prefer to
You prefer the ideological explanation.
Yes,
gotcha.
Yes. Because she's, as far as I know, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, she's a hardcore feminist. And that's why for a real
they all
hardcore...
Are.
But she is the most, as far as I know.
As far as
you
understand, right.
Yes. And, of course, for a hardcore feminist, all this, you know, oil things and politics, you know, in traditional sense, is just all rubbish. Of course. Secondly, I think the legacy of Pussy Riot, that the very construction, the very, you know, the very, you know, in some sense, the very body of this band, of this group, they don't have a vertical ties inside the organization. They have just, you know, horizontal ties, and it's sort of, you know, anarchist group,
right?
Which doesn't have any, you know, leadership, strong leadership.
Rotating membership. It's not clear who the members are.
Yeah.
We only know three for sure, right?
Yeah. And I think that that is a very new thing for Russian politics and Russian, you know, public life.
Mm-hmm.
Even during the, you know, rise of revolutionary movement in Russia in the second part of 19th century, in the beginning of 20th century, all these, you know, revolutionary groups and parties and so on, they were, you know, vertical.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they were. They had, you know, a very strong leadership with, you know, party discipline and so on. And now we have a very different thing. And I think it's very interesting, very important, because the most politically active part of Russian society is, you know, bored to death of all these, you know, strong political parties, movements, and mm-hmm. leaderships, and so on.
I like where you're going.
They prefer to be, you know, half autonomous and so on, but to support something and to be involved in something, in part of the movement, not in the whole movement, because no one shares all the values of all, you know, movements in today's Russia and so on. That is the second legacy. And the third legacy is, of course, that these women are, you know, very courageous. And that's very important, because they are the real fighters, unlike a lot of, you know, opposition leaders. With some, of course,
some exceptions.
Exceptions, of course, but anyway, they show, and still showing, that they can play till the end, and that is very important. That is a very serious moral, you know, example for all the society.
The word that kept coming into my mind, and it's interesting, it came into my mind when we were talking about the Navalny campaign, but the word that came into my mind about Pussy Riot was network. Network. We're not talking about, you know, parties and organizations and movement. We're talking about a loose network. And how many times do we say the word social network, you know, these days? You said a similar thing, by the way, what you just said about Pussy Riot, they're willing to fight to the end. You said the same thing about Navalny, which is actually true. So this is kind of, I mean, what I see them as is sort of a wave of the, I mean, it's a wave of the, of a future of how social activism is going to take place. I don't know what form that's going to take, but it is this very amorphous, loose thing that's very hard to control. You can arrest three of their members and keep two of them in a prison colony, but you don't stamp out the thing, because the network is so loose and amorphous and anonymous that it goes on. Sean, what do you think?
You know, I think the Pussy Riot case was the best and the worst thing that happened to Pussy Riot. What struck me about the most recent song and video is how flat it fell.
Yeah,
it didn't have much traction. And on the one hand, the action in Christ Our Savior Cathedral brought them to complete public attention. They were put in the front, a symbol of the Russian opposition movement. They put the role of art and performance in this movement. And they showed, as Kirill rightly said, that these three women will fight to the end. But on the other hand, it completely personalized Pussy Riot in the persons of these three women. No one cares about the other Pussy Riot members. And I think this is really, this is why I think it kind of fell flat, because the brand has changed so much to embody Samusevich and Alokhina and Tolnikova that the rest of the organization doesn't have the same media power as the three that are, well, the two that are in prison.
And a very interesting thing when we'll see, I mean, the Tolokonikova and Alokhina are due to get out of prison, what is it? It's 6 months down the road, if I'm not mistaken. They got 2 year sentences. They were in for like half a year before. I'm not sure the exact date when they're supposed to get out. But once they get out, this is going to be interesting to see where this goes and what they
and
do.
And I also want to add to this, too. They do, in a way, Pussy Riot does symbolize the Russian opposition movement in general, because it is a network. And the Russian opposition is based in network kind of horizontal politics versus kind of vertical structures and leaderships. But nonetheless, the movement has been personified in a few individuals. And therefore, you know, we've asked this question about Alexei Navalny. Is the movement also include Navalny, or is Navalny the movement? Right. And this is, I think, Pussy Riot kind of symbolizes a similar problem.
Right, so they almost epitomize this power horizontal in a lot of ways.
But they conjure the vertical of it by the fact that their media presence is so strong, right? I mean, you know, the issues that have coalesced around what the opposition movement is now is free Alexei Navalny, right? This is the most identified issue of the last couple of months. Therefore, he is put on a pedestal as, first off, the leader. That everybody says he's the leader. He's also the main cause. And I think for Pussy Riot, it's the same thing. The main cause of that has resulted from the Pussy Riot case has been the two that are in prison. The message of Pussy Riot in general has been diluted, I think, to some extent, because of the tension to the case.
I mean, that's one way to look at it, and maybe I'm getting a little too philosophical. Kirill's probably going to love this. But maybe the vertical is the horizontal, the what I've dubbed the power horizontal, you know, this emerging Russian civil society. Maybe the horizontal model is good when you're fighting for survival in opposition. But as soon as you begin to get some traction,
right,
it becomes more vertical, right?
Or it needs to
by necessity. I mean, really, a horizontal network cannot run for mayor of Moscow. You have to have one man to do that. Kirill, you're shaking your head or doing something with your head.
Yes, if we trying to remember Napoleon times during our podcast, don't forget about the example of Napoleon's campaign in Spain. When Spanish forces tried to struggle or to fight against Napoleon troops on the battlefields, they lost all the battles. But eventually they won because that was a sort of partisan war.
Mm-hmm.
Partisan war is horizontal.
Mm-hmm.
It's not vertical. Of course, it's not so spectacular than to win a battle like Austerlitz and so on. But anyway, the result, pragmatically speaking, was that they won the company and they clear Pyrenees from all Napoleon troops. So I'm a little bit skeptic that if you are trying to fight with Kremlin, you must establish a sort of vertical thing, opposition thing. I think it's more interesting and in some sense more useful to just to live on a horizontal level.
Mm-hmm.
And the example of Pussy Riot, I think, is very important in this context, because when everyone began, of course, especially in Western media and so on, they began to discuss the personality of Nadia Tolokonnikova and so on, with all this glamorous pictures of her and so on, that was a failure. Because Pussy Riot is not about being, an iconic fighters against Putin's regime. It's all about, very, in some sense, very dull things, such, feminist thing about the social problems and the political and the ideological problems. They are not such glamorous.
Mm-hmm.
They're, for ordinary people, is rather dull. But all these things, they connected to everyday life of, you know, ordinary people. And that is a real perspective for opposition, I think. And I'm very sorry, but I think it's the only one possible perspective for Russian opposition.
Well, Carl, I have two thoughts on what you just said. First of all, you seem to have Napoleon on the brain today. And I'm wondering what you're reading, if you're reading some Napoleon or what, some biography, or I don't know. But number two, I think you just went and did it and coined another term. We keep coining terms on this podcast. We can call what's going on with the opposition almost a guerrilla counter-cultural offensive, right? If the Kremlin's waging a cultural campaign, and it's in this vertical sense, the opposition or the civil society or what we have is the power horizontal is waging a guerrilla countercultural offensive. And what we know of the history of guerrilla warfare or partisan warfare is that it's very difficult, if not impossible, to defeat it. So before we're coming up to the end here, before we wrap up, I want to put you both on the spot. 1 year after the verdict, what's Pussy Riot's legacy? Kirill, you can go first because you always have something to say.
Their legacy is that now, first of all, now everyone knows their names. I'm not sure that they intended to become such, you know, popular and so on, but now the names of Nadia Talokonnikova, Maria Lyukhina, and Katya Samutsevich are, you know, in... it's a little bit silly, but they are in some of the list of, you know, great Russian revolutionaries. It's very interesting, but, you know, still, in the same list as, you know, say, Alexander Gerzen, Wilhelm Kuchelbecker, you know, Boris Savinkov, and so on. Secondly, of course, from the moral point of view, they won the campaign. We'll see what will, you know, happen after they will be released from the prison. But now they, from the moral point of view, they won the campaign. And the third part of the legacy that now Russian society has ought to rethink a lot of things about their everyday life and everyday attitude, even to Orthodox Church, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Now I'll give mine. So give Sean a little bit more time here. But
no, I have an answer.
You want to go?
Yeah,
okay, go.
I have an answer. Yeah, it's more of on a down level. Pussy Riot has shown that punk rock still matters.
I love it. Very good.
It can still be political, and as long as it can not only fight off the state, it has to fight off corporatization, because one of the things that can dilute Pussy Riot's message is that it gets marketed and dilute its politics, its feminism, its anarchism, its commitment to revolution to get diluted by the production of commodities and T-shirts and things like this.
Well, my feeling is that, as I said before, they're the personification. They've become the personification of the guerrilla countercultural offensive in a lot of ways. And in this context, they have forced this discussion about what it is that binds modern Russia together. And if this turns out in the long run, as I hope it will, that the modern Russia will be bound together by what binds together every democratic society, and that's civic patriotism, I think they will have played a very positive role in Russian history indeed. So that's my last word. And I guess as the host, I get to say the last word. And unfortunately, that is all we have time for today. I would like to remind you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me via Skype from London has been co-host Kirill Kobrin of RFRL's Russian service and a contributor to the online magazine Politru. And also via Skype joining us from Pittsburgh has been Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian Eastern European Studies and author of the must-read Sean's Russia blog. Thanks, as always, for the great discussion, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I would also like to thank our brilliant and patient producer, Tanya Koncheva. Who I definitely hope never posts my outtakes. I'd also like to thank my indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and most certainly should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper Noize MC.